From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, Project Milwaukee Power Switch continues with an examination of how well Wisconsin's utilities are complying with the state's sustainability mandate. Then we broaden our view to see how other states are viewing renewable energy standards. Then ahead of his cartoon adventure camp, animator Tim Decker says he doesn't need a second language because he speaks in cartoon.
I can draw a cartoon for whatever I want, wherever I'm at, and be able to find my food, find the bathroom, find a cup of coffee, and find anything I'm looking for, a bus, a trolley. All I have to do is draw a cartoon about it. Cartoons are everywhere.
And musician Jeffrey Foucault talks about his latest album, his second collaboration with poet Lisa Olstein.
What's exciting is this idea of sort of compound meaning, where she begins with an idea or a set of intentions and she writes a poem, and then I pick that up and I have no idea necessarily what it's about.
It's all ahead on Lake Effect after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. All this week, we're examining the promises and realities of clean energy in Wisconsin, the portion of the state's energy portfolio today represented by sustainable power sources, and where it might be going in the future. The regulatory body in Wisconsin charged with making sure utilities are meeting the state's sustainability mandate is the Public Service Commission. The commission oversees all public utilities in the state, including electricity, water, natural gas, utilities that combine water and sewer service, and some elements of local phone service. The PSC also has to approve applications for new power projects and for rate hikes. Bob Norcross is the administrator of the Natural Gas and Energy Division of the Commission. He explains the current clean energy standard in Wisconsin to Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
The current renewable energy portfolio standard requires that utilities generate 10% of their electricity from renewable energy. So if you, for instance, if you generate in the course of the year, sell to customers 100 kilowatt hours, you need to generate 10 of those kilowatt hours from renewable energy.
And is that that's the current standard, or that's a standard that the utilities have to meet by a certain time?
That's a standard utilities will have to meet by 2015. However, most of the utilities have reached that point already.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of then what the renewable part of the portfolio is in Wisconsin at this stage? When we talk about renewable energy, what's being generated in a sustainable way here?
Well, it'd be either wind energy, it could be biomass, it could be biogas, it could be hydro, and those solar energy. And those are the main types of energy that are produced from renewables.
Well, and so what is your charge as the PSC in considering sustainability in reviewing a project, say, related to power generation?
Well, when a utility would come forward with a project for approval, say they wanted to build a wind farm, they would, given if it's a certain size of a wind farm, they would come to the commission and get approval for that construction. And we would look at the application, determine whether it's cost effective. And assuming we approved it at that point, at some later date, the utility would come in and look for a rate recovery for the cost of that wind farm.
You talk about cost. Does the PSC also consider other? For example, in terms of wind energy, I gather there's some effort to look at siting as part of the equation as well. Correct?
Yeah, siting is a big issue, particularly with the wind farms. We've had a number of cases where there's been strong public opposition to the siting of the windmills. That's not uncommon.
Well, and how does the PSC come to decide what's an appropriate complaint, if you will, and you know, how does it regard those kinds of concerns?
Well, for a large wind farm, what we would do is have hearings, and in a hearing there would be testimony presented by the utility, by commission staff, by members of the public or any other intervener. So the commission would take all that information into consideration before it would make a decision. And sometimes with those decisions, what the commissioner will do is impose certain conditions on the developer. So if they approve the wind farm, they would say that, for instance, the windmills had to be sited a certain amount of distance away from different residences, or the noise level would have to be below certain levels. So they would look at all different factors and consider that when they make their ultimate decision.
The PSC is a regulatory body. Does it have a role in advocating in one direction or another? I guess the question is, what is the PSC's place in the clean energy equation?
Well, the PSC's place in the equation would be, first, the utilities have a statutory obligation to reach the 10% RPS standard. In the course of a case, like we just described, commission staff would be the ones that would be entering testimony into the record. And commission staff doesn't take a position on the application. We just point out the different factors involved that would be crucial to the three commissioners who ultimately make the decision, but they would need to make that decision.
How does the PSC view its responsibility towards ratepayers versus the utilities versus the other players in the mix?
Well, that's a tough question. The responsibility that the commission has is there's really a balancing that has to go on. I mean, there's the meeting the RPS. There's the cost element that has to be considered, too. I mean, I think there would be certainly some constituencies that would like to see much more done in the way of renewables, but that comes at a cost. So the commission needs to factor that into environmental concerns, landowners' interests, and many other issues that come forth in an application.
Well, and I guess the ultimate question, and I'd be curious to get your take on this, is it possible to develop clean energy and enhance conservation, for that matter, without necessarily harming the bottom line for utilities?
Well, when you say harming the bottom line of the utilities, utilities would see great recovery of the cost. So I think probably the more relevant point would be that the effect it has on ratepayers. So it's when you construct something, you add a cost to the system, it's going to increase rates in all likelihood. And what the commission does do is we look at any kind of an application. We look at whether it's needed and then what's the best alternative for it, factoring in environmental concerns and cost and the best technology for the fuel. I mean, I think for an example, in the last several years, the commission has added about $2.5 billion for renewable projects, which includes $250 million for a biomass plant in Rothschild. At the same time, we were talking about cleaning the air and water. The commission has added about $2.5 billion to clean up existing coal plants as well. So there's a lot of effect on the bottom line, as people have seen, but there's a balancing that has to go on.
Well, and presumably when people are considering, when ratepayers are considering costs, this is the notion that the amount that the utilities have invested in their infrastructure, if that infrastructure is going to change, someone's going to bear the cost.
That's right.
There was a report not long ago by the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, which is a generally free market think tank, that concluded that green energy at this stage is a money-losing proposition. Can this be both the right time and the wrong time to be having this conversation?
Well, whether it's the right time to consider the cost of renewable energy, I mean, there's a need to meet the statutory requirements for the renewable portfolio standard, and there can be situations when a utility needs to add some type of generation. It could be, given the utility's portfolio, that it would be cheaper to do some form of renewable energy than different options for like coal or gas, for instance. So it's really on a case-by-case basis that would determine whether it can be an effective approach or not.
And should I assume that the PSC doesn't necessarily have a viewpoint on whether the standards should be enhanced or not?
No, I mean, that's a legislative action, what the RPS would be. Right now it's 10%, and that's what we are regulating towards.
Are there other aspects to where the PSC falls in this that you think people ought to understand?
Well, I think the big key that people need to understand is just the whole balancing the commission has to do. When you're looking at the cost, you're looking at environmental concerns. It's just there's a real balancing that has to go on there, that different people have different views on the direction they'd like to head. And the commission tries to factor those views in and do what's best in what's in the public interest.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective on this, and hope we can talk again.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
Bob Norcross is the administrator of the Natural Gas and Energy Division of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Coming up next on the program, the environment for renewable energy laws in state legislatures in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Project Milwaukee Power Switch continues on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Our Project Milwaukee coverage continues on Milwaukee Public Radio all week. And before the break, we got a snapshot of the renewable energy mandate for Wisconsin utilities from the state's Public Service Commission. The commission does not make the requirements. It only sees that the standards set by the legislature are carried out. Maria Gallucci writes about the politics of clean energy for the website Inside Climate News. Recently, she wrote about how state legislatures around the country are viewing renewable energy standards. Speaking with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke by phone from New York, Gallucci offered her analysis of how state legislatures are treating clean energy mandates.
It's really kind of a mix. You see, a number of these bills, at last count, there's about 40 that are seeking to either water down or repeal these renewable portfolio standards. But then you also see about 20 or so that are aiming to strengthen the standards. And it's really kind of across the board because some of these bills, maybe they don't really have any legs or there's not much momentum behind them. And in some cases, there is really a concerted effort to get them in place and maybe scale back some of the policies that we have. So it's something that we've seen grow over the past couple of years. Seems to have crescendoed a bit this year in particular, but it really kind of varies depending on where you go.
Well, let's talk about the first side of that, and that's the effort to weaken or repeal the standards at the state level. What do you know about what's behind that effort? Does it come primarily from an ideological standpoint, or are you seeing it as an economic issue for say, companies that are having a hard time meeting standards?
It's really both of those things. I think maybe the majority probably come at it from an ideological standpoint. Legislators who don't think necessarily that the state government should be dictating where the utility companies get their energy supplies. And a lot of this effort has been supported by national organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council or the Heartland Institute, which oppose these mandates and have been developing model legislation that legislators can use to sort of craft their own policies. But you're also seeing policymakers who are interested in supporting the energy industries in their own districts. In Wisconsin, for example, Representative Andre Dack, I believe, has supported a measure to incorporate nuclear power into the state's renewable portfolio standard, and two of the state's three nuclear plants are in his district. So you see kind of this effort to support the energy industries. And also there is an economic concern as well. Companies may be concerned that they don't have the money or the resources to develop renewable electricity as the mandate requires them to do. And so they're looking to either extend or maybe scale back a bit those regulations.
How prevalent are RPS laws around the country in the first place? How many states have them and how long have they been around?
I believe it's 30 states and Washington, D.C. who have RPS laws, and they've been around for a while. The first ones really got off the ground in the late 1990s, but the majority of these standards came about in the early to mid-2000s, and some states have actually gone back in and increased their standards as well. Maybe they started off with modest goals, and they've boosted them in the years since.
Are we at the point where those standards are actually being met in the states where RPS laws are in effect?
I think it will depend on where you go. I think in some cases, the utility companies very much are on track. I know in California that the three big utilities there say, that they're set to meet the ambitious RPS goal there, which is 30% by 2030, I believe. And so we are seeing actually that utilities are meeting these goals. And so that's sort of interesting to think about these efforts to repeal the standards. Well, a lot of utilities have already factored these mandates into their plans and are already making the purchases and the decisions needed to comply.
Getting back to some of the efforts to repeal laws, you write about at least one effort that challenges the standards on constitutional grounds. I think that's going on in Colorado. What can you tell us about that?
So the American Tradition Partnership, which is a free market advocacy group, filed a lawsuit in 2011 with its sister organization, the American Tradition Institute. And that argues that Colorado's renewable portfolio standard is unconstitutional because it's discriminating against electricity that's generated in other states and perhaps consumed in Colorado. The Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution says or implies that states cannot regulate economic activity beyond their own border, and thus by making decisions about energy outside of Colorado, this lawsuit is arguing that it's violating that standard.
You also mentioned that there's something like 20 efforts underway on the state level to strengthen standards. What sorts of efforts are those? Is it really just making the standards tougher, or are there other sort of novel efforts underway to encourage the use of renewables?
So actually, the latest one came out of Minnesota. The governor there recently approved a law that creates a solar carve-out, which means that of the percentage of renewables that utilities are required to provide, 1.5% has to come from solar specifically. And some states already have carve-outs like those, and that's really to make sure that certain types of technologies that maybe the public and lawmakers want to see more of get built, and you know, not some of these more traditional sources of renewable energy like large-scale wind farms or, in some cases, hydropower. In New Hampshire, for example, lawmakers there raised the amount of small-scale solar systems that utilities could put on the grid. In some places, there's limits, concerns that too many of these systems will overload the grid, cause complications, and so they put these caps, essentially. In New Hampshire, they raised that cap, which means that utilities can use more small-scale solar to comply with the mandate.
What do we know about public sentiment for these kinds of standards and developing more renewable sources of power?
Well, it seems that there's a variety of polls for anything. It seems that the polls around renewable energy seem to indicate that there is strong public sentiment for renewable energy and taking action on climate change in general. And you folks are really eager to see these types of new technologies be developed and also to see policies that enable them to use them as well, you know, enable folks to get energy-saving retrofits or to install solar panels on the rooftop, something to make it more accessible at the local level.
Maria Gallucci, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Maria Gallucci is a reporter for Inside Climate News. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about her coverage of renewable energy in state legislatures. You'll find a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Tomorrow on the show, our Project Milwaukee Power Switch series continues with a look at the economics of clean energy, plus new innovations in solar and nuclear power, and some opposition to wind power from an unlikely source. And don't forget, on Friday, you can tune in to listen to our Project Milwaukee Forum on the future of clean energy in Wisconsin, recorded in front of a live studio audience at Discovery World. Coming up next, if your kid's idea of summer camp involves staying indoors, perhaps next week's cartoon camp in Wauwatosa would be just the thing. We'll learn more about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Stay tuned. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. If your child shudders at the thought of a traditional summer camp, there is another option coming along next week in Wauwatosa. Cartoon Adventure Camp is 5 days introduction to the art of cartooning, puppet making, and claymation, and it's offered by former Simpsons and Disney animator Tim Decker. Decker is currently teaching cartooning and animation at UW-Milwaukee and at MATC. He's also dedicated to, in his words, working with the artists of tomorrow. He joins me in the studio now to chat with us about his Cartoon Adventure Camp. Tim, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you so much, Bonnie, for having me.
This one-week introduction to the art of cartooning, it's camp with a bit of a difference. How come I didn't have this kind of camp when I was a kid?
I don't know. You weren't fortunate.
I was not.
No.
You know, so what is the idea behind this? What are you hoping to impart to the kids in a week?
What I'm trying to do is have the kids explore cartoon art and cartoon animation. And what I'm really incorporating in this camp is the kids will come in, they'll design in 2D, 3D, they'll explore a little bit of acting, a little bit of animation, and a lot of storytelling.
Okay. So when you say 3D, you're talking about like claymation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they're actually going to make clay models and things?
They're going to go from concept to final design. So they will draw their cartoon characters with me, like in the cartoon part of the camp. We'll be drawing like cartoon bears, polar bears, draw, you know, dogs, giraffes, monkeys, hippos, elephants. And then we'll have little scribble-offs like you and I did in the warm-up here. And then also they're in the puppet class. They'll take a concept. They'll design their sock puppet in a 2D way, and then they'll build it out in a 3D way. So they'll make the actual puppet after they draw it and design it. And that's the same goes with their claymation stop motion, which is, I think, is amazing, is because in the stop motion portion of this, I also have one of my ex-students, Tommy Sims, is going to be teaching in there with me. And the great thing is the kids are going to build their own sets, and the sets are going to be a portable set that they can take home and make films all summer with. And I think that's a lot of fun. But they'll be drawing the characters and then building the characters out of clay.
This is 5 days, right?
5 days.
Okay. So starting on day one, they're going to be just kind of getting the idea of cartooning? I mean, I'm assuming – what is the age range, first of all?
Age range is 9 to 14.
So some of these kids may have had drawing experience. Are you accepting kids who don't?
Oh, yeah. They're all artists. Every kid is an artist. Everybody's an artist. It's society that pushes the artist out of the children. And I'm here to bring the artist back. Because, you know, in kindergarten, like they say, you ask how many kids are artists, they all raise their hands. By the time you get to high school, you say, how many are artists? You get two or three. And that's because, you know, I went through it. Everybody goes through it. I'm going to be an artist. Oh, you're going to starve, kid. No, you're not going to starve. You're going to be one of the most creative people in the world. And without art, science is nothing. Everything else is nothing without art.
How are you setting this up? I mean, kids are applying, or you must have a cutoff of the number of kids that you can comfortably take care of in
oh, for
five
sure.
days. Yeah.
Well, my cutoff is at 60, which means 20 kids in each section.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm not near that. So it's going to be a fun section. It's going to be a fun camp. It's going to be a small enough camp where it's going to be really individual one-on-one.
Where is it happening?
It's happening at St. Jude in Wauwatosa, St. Jude's school there.
And so kids will show up at, say, 9 o'clock and then leave at what?
3 o'clock.
3. Okay.
9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. There's three sections of two-hour classes, and they'll get all three classes. So I think it's going to be a lot of exploratory things. And then at lunchtime, I plan to show classic cartoons and talk about classic animation and see what the cartoons are about, like classic Tex Avery cartoons, Bob Clampett cartoons, and the old UPA cartoons. You know, those guys were the greatest animators in the world.
For those of us who don't know, what cartoons did those guys do?
Like Tex Avery, one of my favorite Tex Avery cartoons is Rockabye Point, The Legend of Rockabye Point. And that's about a polar bear and Chilly Willy. And they're trying to steal salmon from a salmon fish and ship. And it's just a series of just hilarious gags. And it was done so well. You know, some of the stuff today probably wouldn't go over so well, like, you know, dropping an anvil on somebody's head, that's still considered kind of crazy. But that's classic cartooning.
Mm-hmm.
And kids are going to be exposed to that. And then like things like Gerald McBoing Boing by United Picture Artists. Those guys were like the beatniks of animation. They took all the rules that Disney tried to apply to animation and just broke them all. And they just did some amazing things like Gerald McBoing Boing.
So the idea is that the kids are going to have practical hands-on experience of actually doing this, but then also getting a little bit of, you know, exposure to stuff they may not see because, I mean, that's stuff that unless you were of a certain age, you probably weren't seeing in the theater.
No. And, well, some of the stuff the kids do see, and I talk to a lot of kids when I go to schools, and the elementary school kids, every one of them, which I love, is always mentioning to me Tom and Jerry. They always bring up Tom and Jerry.
Do you think they're finding that on the internet? Do you think they're YouTubing that?
No, they can find it on Cartoon Network.
Oh, okay.
And they all watch Tom and Jerry, and they all think it's hilarious, and I love that. And the generation's coming up right now, you know, because I teach at UWM and METC. They all want to do more 2D animation. And
why do you think that is, as opposed to the 3D?
Well, I think they don't know what films are like without 3D. So then they explore back into the old school 2D stuff, and they're all starting to explore that and have a lot more fun with it. And all kids love to draw cartoons. Who doesn't like to draw a cartoon when you're in school? I mean, you know, every kid I know can draw a cartoon. And if they can't, they have an interest in it, and they want to learn how to draw a cartoon. And that's what I'm around for.
Do you think that you'll get more boys or girls, or do you think it's going to be a pretty even split in this camp?
You know, I traveled around the United States last year with the Imagination Station. I went to 7 cities. And it usually evened out, mostly boys and girls. But the ones that really focus and really get the job done in the claymation aspect and stop motion are usually the girls. And they usually focus pretty hard on their story. The boys, I get them in there and they want to build. They want to just take off and shoot it. And I'm like, no. We got to make a story here. We got to make a simple story, a simple, simple cause and effect story. And the boys sometimes really get into it and they really jam at the drawing and the building. But the girls really get into the storytelling and they really focus on that and they really have something to say. They really want to express themselves. And that's what this camp is about, for them to express themselves through cartoons. You know, all these kids need an outlet for their art. You know, all the arts are, you know, a lot. We're lucky here in Wisconsin. We still have great art teachers in the public schools. But that's, you know, wavering. We have to keep that up. We have to keep these kids inspired and get them out there.
So at the end of the camp, I know you said they're going to have a little kit to take home with them. What's going to be in that kit that they can do to continue cartooning in any, whether it's 2D, 3D, puppetry, whatever they really latch onto and say, mm-hmm. Oh, that's the thing I really love. What's every kid going to go away with?
Well, everyone's going to have their sock puppets they designed. And everybody has old socks that aren't matched at their house, and they can take those socks and make them into puppets. Once they learn the little formulas I teach them, they'll be making puppets and mom and dad will be like, oh my God, there's way too many sock puppets in this house. And then the studio set that I give them, I have boxes. I bought boxes and it says Quiet on the Set on them and it'll say Cartoon Adventure on them. And what it is they build that set and they can fold the one flap back up, put the lid on it and carry their studio home. And I'm not saying that they have to build their studio permanently. They can take what's in that studio box, take it down, and put it in another set. So you could build an outdoor set. You could build a kitchen. You could build anything in there. And then shoot with a digital camera. And I think that'll be exciting for them.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that I think makes this possible is the, you know, the fact that almost everybody has a phone that's got a digital camera in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. When I think about you know, what it was like to do that when I was a kid, you know, you had to have somebody with a 16-millimeter camera and you had to know a lot more. Now you just have to have your cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. You have your cell phone or a digital camera and it's immediate.
Mm-hmm.
You see exactly what you shot. And you see how it looks. Like before, like in our day, you would have to shoot it and then
develop it
and hope that you had your exposures right and hope that you shot things correctly. Hope it was all in focus. And if it wasn't, you painstakingly had to go back and try to reset up and recreate that whole situation.
Right.
And that's really hard.
Now, are you hoping that there are going to be some kids in this group that will say, you know what, this is what I want to do with my life?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
There are kids out there right now that say, this is what I want to do with my life. By third grade, I told everybody I was going to be a cartoonist. You know, and everybody was like, well, what are you really going to do? I'm going to be a cartoonist. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a cartoonist. I'm going to draw. I'm going to animate. I'm going to make cartoons.
What is it about cartoons that makes kids in third grade say, I want to do this?
They look simple and they're more approachable. And this goes throughout the world. Cartoon art goes throughout the world. I mean, I've told people many times that I don't need to speak a language because I speak in cartoon. I can draw a cartoon for whatever I want, wherever I'm at, and be able to find my food. Find the bathroom, find a cup of coffee, and find anything I'm looking for, a bus, a trolley. All I had to do is draw a cartoon about it. Cartoons are everywhere. Cartoons were one of the first expressions done by man. And they're very simplistic, and kids are drawn to them because they're inviting. They don't look that difficult to do. And actually, they are difficult, but after you learn certain formulas, it's not that difficult.
Now, at the end of the 5 days, will there be a public performance of any kind, or are you keeping this purely within the camp?
Purely within the camp, purely with the kids. Because, you know, last year when I was traveling around the United States, they were trying to get the kids to make a performance, and it became a lot of stress on the kids. I want them just to create their characters and go home and make their performances. I want them to make their characters and dive into character development and dive into concept art and just explore what they can do. And my job is to inspire them to take it further when they get home, to keep it up, to keep drawing, to keep working with their art.
So, of course, the big question that I have is, are you going to do this for adults too?
For adults, I would love to do it. I do it already over at the universities.
But I'm thinking camp, adult camp.
Adult camps would be fun. I did this last fall was kind of amazing. I did a sock puppet workshop with senior citizens out in West Dallas. And I had so much fun. And they were so much fun. There was about 15 of them. And they're all senior citizens. And they all were sewing buffs. So they taught me stuff. I mean, you know. I'm a glue gun guy. I'm not a seamstress, but all these little ladies were just so much fun, and they came up with so many fun little puppets, and they loved it, and they were making Christmas presents out of puppets. And, you know, by the end of the day, they were talking with their puppets and making little shows with themselves. It was hilarious.
It just sounds to me like it would be a fun thing for adults to do as well. Maybe not a whole week of doing it, but like, boy, a day of
a making, workshop. A workshop would be fun. I would do a workshop anywhere.
All right. Well,
anything to get the cartoons out, you know, and get people doing things.
Well, let's hope that it happens. But certainly Cartoon Adventure Camp is coming up. What do kids need to bring? Just their imaginations?
Yep, their imaginations, and be ready to go to Cartoon Boot Camp.
Well, Tim, thank you so much. And, you know, you need to gather up the loose cartoons. They're running around the studio.
Yeah, I know. They're going crazy. They escaped. I know. They're running out of my pen like crazy.
They are.
Yes.
So gather them up, and thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Bonnie. It's always nice to see you.
Tim Decker teaches animation, puppetry, and character drawing at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and at the Milwaukee Area Technical College. His Cartoon Adventure Camp begins on Monday. There's more information about how to sign up for it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then singer-songwriter and Wisconsin native Jeffrey Foucault joins us in our performance studio for conversation and some tunes. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. For non-musicians, the skills of an accomplished singer-songwriter are almost too much to reconcile, the idea that smart words and evocative melodies would both come to the mind of the same person. Both skills require a lot of hard work, of course, but the finished product often sounds effortless. In the case of musician and Wisconsin native Jeffrey Foucault, there's another skill in his arsenal that's just as impressive, his ability to interpret the lyrics of others and integrate them with his own music. Foucault writes plenty of his own songs, of course, but his latest album, recorded with his band Cold Satellite, is his second collaboration with poet Lisa Olstein. As with the previous album, for the latest called Cavalcade, Olstein serves up the words and Foucault picks up the process from there. The result fuses together styles ranging from folk to rock to R&B. Cold Satellite played several shows in Wisconsin and also stopped by the Lake Effect studio for a concert and conversation with Mitch Tyke. They started with a track from Cavalcade called Sleeper's Wake. Just right.
four drinks, let's go mad.
Cold Satellite in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, Sleepers Wake. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us in. It's a pleasure.
And you are Jeffrey Foucault.
I am Jeffrey Foucault, yeah.
And you have a band arrayed around you in the room.
I do. We got all the gear up here. We had to load in from the street and come up seven floors with, but it's a pretty limited rig compared to what we normally have.
But still, no small achievement, and we are grateful.
Yeah, well, thanks for doing it.
Well, as we said, the song was Sleepers Wake, and this is one of 11 songs, I think, on the new CD, which is your second collaboration with Lisa Olsteen.
Yeah, we made the first record. We started writing it, the process sort of came together in 2006 and 7, and then Goody, the electric guitar player, and I, David Goodrich, we took those tunes and arranged them and recorded them as demos for a couple of years, different versions of them. And then we finally said, what we need is a band. So we hired this band and we all came together. And that was the first time we'd all played together in 2009. And we made a record and put it out in the States in 2010 and in Europe in 2011 and decided to do a follow-up with a label that was an indie project. And this one's coming out on Signature Sounds.
Can we flash back to 2006 and 2007? How did the collaboration first come about at all?
I don't know why. Lisa gave me a blue folder with a bunch of poems and fragments that didn't work as poems or weren't included in books, and then some fragments, and then I think two or three that were she was writing them as lyrics, but she hadn't written any lyrics before, or I guess she had done a little bit, but didn't have a lot of experience with it, so she was sort of guessing about the form. And I had made a record called Ghost Repeater, and I was ready to create stuff and like make music, but I really wasn't ready to do any lyric writing. So I took this folder out and started reading them, and before I would get too far into them, I'd hit record and start making a song out of them. And it was a real pleasure, and so the project took on a life of its own. And, you know, it's a distance collaboration. We don't really talk about the process or the meaning or the form of things very much.
Well, I feel bad that she is not here to defend herself.
I don't.
These questions.
I don't. I'm free to say anything I want. Yeah.
But was she, if you can speak for her in this way, was she really looking for another voice to come out of her poetry? Because, is the music another voice? It's another dimension in some way?
It's hard for me to say. I think she initially thought that I would maybe just use some of the lines and things as lyric ideas or jumping off places. And so it was collaborative in that sense. But I don't think she expected me to set them to music whole. But then I think what she was excited about is, you know, like you said, sort of the added dimension of it. And also for both of us, what's exciting is this idea of sort of compound meaning where she begins with an idea or a set of intentions and she writes a poem. And then I pick that up and I have no idea necessarily what it's about. And it makes me feel a certain way. It colors the way that I approach the musical side of things. And then those two things are brought together in the song, and then the listener, you know, unites the two things. And then there's a third meaning, sort of this triangle. And so the alchemical side of the process is what's exciting for us.
You are working with somebody else's emotions in this. Is it a daunting feeling or do you feel like you have the artistic freedom to say, well, I'm going to take whatever I feel out of these and make it my own?
Yeah, no, it's really freeing. It feels great to sit down and not feel either responsible for or beholden to ideas and language. You know, I really just edit for the most part, and then I sort of adapt, you know, and curate the language, but I don't necessarily feel any responsibility for meaning or content, which I love that. I get to be a musician, and I think it makes me a better musician to just think about form.
Do you feel like the process for you has evolved since that first time you sat down in 2006, 2007?
Yeah, and the main evolution was just knowing that these guys were going to be on the record and that was the band that I was writing for, and I knew where the beat would fall and how everybody would sort of play around it. Within reason, you know, you always go into the studio and things change and people surprise you, and that's one of the best parts about it.
Do you want to play another song for us?
Yeah, we're going to do this sort of classic form country tune called Careless Flame. And Hayward's going to count it in.
trees that cry in your ears. That's a ferry boat leaving 1 week ago for you. And all my best prayer and my ticket was bought. We stayed up through the night. We made love and then we fought. And on some stranger's tongue. Today I heard your name. And it flickered and went out like a candle.
I feel like I ought to be nursing the last of something in a glass in front of me. That was a great song.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Before I go any further, we mentioned this whole band that is arrayed in the studio, and we really ought to give credit where credit is due. Who's here with us?
So in the sonic field, directly to my right, Mr. Jeremy Moses Curtis is playing the bass, and he's from he lives in Uxbridge, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. And then on the keyboard is Mr. Hayward Williams, who lives right here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a fine songwriter with a number of his own solo records. And Hayward plays keyboards and guitars and sings a lot of the backing vocals. On one lonely snare drum today, Mr. Billy Conway, normally playing a full kit out of Wausau, Montana. And on the pedal steel guitar out of Nashville, Tennessee, Alex McCullough. And on the electric guitar, Mr. David Goodrich, who is lately of Western Massachusetts, but is moving to Austin, Texas, pretty quick here.
Which is kind of the Western Massachusetts of Texas.
It is, yeah. It's the same deal. You move to town, and they get you like a case of white wine and a Volvo.
Well, Star beer.
It is great to have all of you here. I wanted to ask you this, getting back to this collaboration with Lisa a little bit more. Do you feel like – have you learned something about songwriting from working with someone who is all about the writing?
Yeah, yeah, certainly. If nothing else, you learn how other people put language together, and you look at it differently. The thing that I think was the handiest to me as a songwriter was realizing that if I sat down with a complete lyric in front of me instead of tinkering away at a verse or two verses or a few sort of fragments for a long time, if I had the whole thing, it would allow me to write a melody really fast. You know, I could write a melody in 5-10 minutes, you know, and that one, you know, the one we just played, I think that took, you know, as long to write it as it did to sing it, and then it was done. And I think I get bogged down in the process, so I tried to separate the two things a little bit more, try to write more complete things in my notebook before I bring the musical side around. So,
where do you come down on the whole idea of all song lyrics being a form of poetry?
Well, they're not. They're different. Sometimes you can read a lyric and it'll stand up all on its own. You know, there aren't that many of them though, and it doesn't matter. You know, the thing is that there are a lot of lyrics that are bad, or you know, just syrupy or goofy. But if the right singer is singing, and you give it to Ray Charles or somebody, that's, you know, everything's going to be just fine. So, obviously, you know, the lyric tradition grew up out of a written tradition, or maybe they just have always sort of depended on each other at the same time, running in parallel, because they certainly have different rules. And a great poem could be a bad song, and a great song could be a bad poem, and, you know, that's just how it is.
You said this is largely a distance collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Does Lisa come to the shows ever?
She does. In fact, on the East Coast, we just did a tour last month, and she came and read at a couple of the shows. And we really love it when that happens. And we've tried to find ways to work it into the show. Night to night, it's different. We've tried playing recordings of her reading them. And then last night, I read sort of an excerpt as we were going through the end of a tune where the tune was falling apart. And that worked out okay. We really do love it. And it adds a dimension. And it also adds some legibility, because sometimes it's really hard to tell what I'm saying. And the lyrics are dense and, you know. Nice thing.
Well, and I wonder if one of the other ancillary effects of this is that you bring some other people to Lisa's poetry who might not have known it, and she brings some people to your music who might otherwise not have known it.
Yeah, I would think so. I hope so. That's, you know, that would be the ideal.
You have this Boston connection. We were actually talking during the setting up process. I gather you all were playing in Cambridge the night of the big manhunt in Boston.
We were. We got locked down, and then we had to break out. But we played a place called the Lizard Lounge in Cambridge and we were probably coming off stage when they had that shootout on the MIT campus, and we lucked out. We would have driven right sort of through that area if we had gone a different direction on the way back to where we were staying. And then we woke up in the morning, and it was the one place we weren't all in a hotel, so we were all distributed around Somerville for the most part, which is just abuts Cambridge. And they didn't have a direct lockdown. They said they'd prefer it if you stayed indoors. So we were able to get to the next gig. We just drove around real fast, and streets were pretty dead. Picked everybody up and drove out of town. But it was a long day, and then we got all the way up to northern Vermont, and we played in Burlington. And we were sitting in the van. We had an iPhone plugged in, running the police scanner, listening to the whole thing go down. It's just sort of craziness, that whole thing.
Well, and I always wonder, you know, when you are on tour and your job is to, you know, play night after night and be in this universe of playing music for people who are there to see you play music. Whether you can ever truly be a refuge from what's happening in the world around you?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, certainly we had a good show that night, and the bar felt like a totally fine place to be. You know, nobody was – I certainly wasn't worried, you know, running around town that day that something else was going to happen. And really, when you think of it, you know, everybody was on edge and all worried about it. It was a 17-year-old kid running around, you know, hiding in a boat, and the whole town was shut down just out of this sort of uncertainty. And, you know, it wasn't that big a deal, truthfully, once they figured out who they were looking for. So.
Unfortunately, he was not at your show.
Yeah. No, he wasn't at the show. I've had some strange people show up at that venue, but he wasn't one of them.
Well, Jeffrey Fokold, and all of you, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Congratulations on the new CD, and I hope you come back and see us again.
Yeah, thanks for having us in. It's really a pleasure to get to come back and play in Milwaukee.
As always. Well, anytime. And what are you going to play us out with?
We'll play out with the title track from this new record. So this is called Cavalcade.
Over there, there at the kitchen, it's real nice in the rain. Right here is the sofa, buddy, an old map spain. Before the revolution was queen, but I can't.
The album is called Cavalcade. The words are by poet Lisa Olstein. The tunes are written by Jeffrey Foucault. The songs were played in Studio C1 by Foucault and the members of Cold Satellite: Jeremy Moses Curtis on bass, Milwaukee's own Hayward Williams on keyboard, Billy Conway on drums, Alex McCullough on pedal steel guitar, and David Goodrich on electric guitar. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke joined them on the interview mic, and our performance was engineered by John Strelecki. Jeffrey Foucault will be back in his home state for solo shows in Fort Atkinson and Marshfield later this month. You'll find a link to his full tour schedule at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
You can hold a pistol to my head. You can lie.